workshop here. So I'm from PTB, which is Germany's National Metrology Institute, working on optical clocks, and I will speak a bit about how these can be used to investigate changes of fundamental constants. So the outline of my talk, I will start with an introduction why optical clocks are good devices for precision measurements. And then more specifically, I will speak about our system with a trapped ytterbium ion that we have been looking at for some time already. I will show what kind of limits on temporal variations we can impose from these data. And then I will speak about, in a perspective, about two other transitions that we are addressing now and that will provide a much higher sensitivity to changes of the fine structure constant. So the basic outline of an optical clock or frequency standard looks like this. So the oscillator of such a clock is a laser that is short term stabilized to a macroscopic body, to a stable reference resonator, and of course in the long run it is stabilized to an atomic transition. And in the high precision versions of optical clocks used today, this is always forbidden narrow transitions of trapped and laser cooled particles. This is done in order to reduce the possible systematic shifts. And the idea here is that the laser really represents the frequency of the unperturbed atom under ideal conditions. And the optical frequency is say 10 to the 15 hertz, so it cannot be directly counted electronically. And so one needs a kind of a clockwork, the so-called femtosecond comb generator that provides the precise division of the optical frequency down to the radio frequency range where it can be counted optically, where a clock signal, one tick per second, can be generated. And also this comb generator provides very precise means for measuring optical frequency ratios, that is measuring dimensionless numbers to very high precision. So now why is it important or beneficial to use optical transitions? The stability of an oscillator is often characterized by this by the Allen deviation, which is very practical because it gives experimenters a way to diagnose different noise types. And the deviation here for a frequency standard is given by this expression. The atoms are usually interrogated in a cyclic fashion. So there is a cycle time, there is a certain atom number, and there is a line width, which is in all optimized frequency standards is simply the inverse of the probe time that is related to the cycle time. So the line width enters into the instability, and then inversely it is proportional to the reference frequency. And so if the cycle time is given, say you have a 1 second observation time, you get a 1 hertz Fourier limited line width, and then the main factor to win on this instability here is by increasing the carrier phase frequency, that is the optic going to an optical frequency from a microwave to an optical frequency. This typically increases by 5 orders of magnitude. This gives you high stability. Another advantage of the optical clock is that it can provide also very high accuracy. This is because some of the shifts that experimenters have to deal with are independent of the frequency, and so they are less important for an optical frequency than for a microwave frequency. There is counterexamples also, of course. So for example, the relativistic Doppler shift is just proportional to the temperature, so that is why we have to cool particles. And it is proportional to the frequency. So here one does not gain from going to a higher frequency. But for example, looking at a Zeeman shift, this is determined mainly by magnetic moment, say, of the nucleus of the electron. So it is a given energy scale. And so relatively, it is much less important in the optical range. Here I've given the numbers for our ytterbium frequency standard, where at 1 microtesla we have a quadratic Zeeman shift in the range 10 minus 17. Whereas for a cesium clock transition here, the present definition of the SI second, relatively, it's 5 orders of magnitude more important. So an advantage of the optical clock, systematic shifts can be controlled more efficiently. And I mentioned one can measure with high stability. So here is shown the measurement of optical frequency ratios. Now, actually, dimensionless numbers measured with a femtosecond comb. And here, this Allen standard deviation is plotted as a function of the averaging time. And here, two different optical frequency ratios are taken simply by from lasers that, were available in the laboratories. And the instability here is compared to a hydrogen maser, which is the most stable frequency reference in the microwave range. And you can see that optical frequency allow much higher stability. So here, these are two different laser frequencies, so they're where the really non-integer ratio is measured. And the instability here is delimited by technical noise in these lasers. But here, in this example, the frequency ratio was imposed in the experiment by taking one laser and generating its second harmonic, and by energy conservation, so the factor 2 in the frequency is now fixed in this measurement. And here it is shown how this factor 2 could be measured, and you can see that within within a bit more than a minute, this factor 2 could be measured to 18 digits. And so this shows the prospects of doing very high stability measurements with optical frequencies and frequency ratios. This plot in a bit more detail shows several demonstrated instabilities. So again, it's the Allen deviation as a function of measuring time. So there is some macroscopic oscillators, cavities, cryo oscillators that are used as flywheels, hydrogen masers that unfortunately they are drift off at longer averaging time. But then there is the atomic clocks like the present cesium fountain clock averaging down like 1/√ of time. And then here's a number of optical frequency comparisons showing 10^-15 typically instability after a bit more than a minute. The reference systems used here, there's quite a variety. So there is, as I mentioned, the most highest precision experiments have been done on laser-cooled and trapped samples. There is two systems. There is neutral atoms and optical traps, and there is laser-cooled ions. And both subjects here will be covered in several talks at this conference. Of course, also it would be interesting to look at simple calculable atoms like helium, hydrogen. Very high precision work has indeed also been performed, but it's more difficult to trap and cool these atoms. Molecules are very interesting, and a new system that I will be talking about a bit is nuclear resonance, is optical nuclear resonance in the thorium. So in my talk, I will cover examples from these two areas, from the trapped ions and from the nuclear. And there will be more talks here on optical traps with neutral atoms and also on molecules. So our system that we are studying at PTB is trapped laser-cooled ions. So a single ion is kept in a radio frequency trap, a structure of three electrodes producing a time-dependent quadrupole field. Here you can see the actual experimental device, the three electrodes, a ring, two end caps, a small source, a small atomic oven to produce some of the ytterbium atoms in this case, and then an electron source for ionizing. And we then keep a single ion in this trap, laser cool it to a millikelvin temperature, and this basically provides nearly ideal conditions for high resolution spectroscopy. The particle is well localized in the so-called Lamb-Dicke limit, where it is allowed to move less than the wavelengths of the radiation we interrogated with. We can look at it for a very long time. In fact, the ytterbium ion shows very long trapping times, like we have trapped one ion for more than a year. The time scale for the interrogation is 1 second, but at this time scale, yeah, we can make long experimental runs with the same ion. And it's a very simple system. It's basically a single atom in very good control over environmental perturbations. Of course, a single ion will not give you a very strong signal, but this can be overcome by averaging and also by using very narrow transitions to provide the high short-term stability. So this shows the level scheme of ytterbium plus. It looks a bit complicated, but it's in fact basically it can be seen as a single electron system, S1/2 ground state, the line we use for the resonance line we use for cooling, to the P1/2 state, and then the reference transition of our frequency standard that we are using now, an electric quadrupole transition from S1/2 to D3/2 state. Lifetime of this state about 50 milliseconds. And so a 3 hertz natural line width. Two more repumping lasers are needed to ensure a cyclic excitation. And technically, it's an advantage that all these wavelengths can be generated from diode lasers, efficient small laser systems. A single particle is trapped and then submitted to an experimental sequence, where at first we cool the particle, prepare it in this F equals zero hyperfine ground state level, then all the cooling lasers are switched off. A pulse of radiation on this quadrupole transition is applied. During this propulse, we also switch the magnetic field in order to lower the contribution from the Zeeman effect. And then afterwards, the cooling laser light is switched on again in order to detect whether the ion has been transferred to the metastable state or not. And so one bit of spectroscopic information is gained in such a cycle to see whether the excitation is taking place or not. And averaging over this, we can then measure spectra of the excitation spectra on this reference transition. So here at each frequency, 20 such cycles have been performed, and the number of excitations is counted. So the noise you see here is mainly just the counting statistics. And then this experiment has been performed here for different durations of the propulse laser. And you see that we always get Fourier limited resolution. So at 1 millisecond interrogation, we get a kilohertz wide line, and we get close to 100% excitation probability. And if we increase the resolution here, we go to 90 milliseconds, we get a 10 hertz Fourier limited line width, very high line Q, a few 10 to the 13. But now the excitation probability has dropped to about 50%. This is simply due to the fact that this propulse is already two times the lifetime of the metastable state. And so we have decay. The maximum excitation probability is limited by the decay process. And now this line can be used to lock the laser. So the laser alternately interrogates the line in the wings here on the left side, on the right side. The excitation probability is measured, and from this, a signal can be derived to stabilize the laser frequency in the long term. The long term means over a sequence of a few such excitations, that is, on a time scale of a few seconds. In order to test the performance of such a system, we have built an experiment where we have two independent ion trap systems, two traps, each one holding a single ytterbium ion. The lasers are shared, so the cooling laser is split to two traps. The probe laser is also split for two traps. But then we run the two probe laser beams through two independent acousto-optic modulators in order to be able to independently steer the frequencies of these two beams. And then there are two, and then with each trap there is a photodetection system measuring the rate of the transitions, generating an error signal, and writing it back to this modulator here. And in this way, we can very easily compare the two optical frequencies realized by the two ions. And this was a setup we used to perform a number of measurements on possible systematic shifts in the system. The effect that we are worrying about is mainly field-induced shift due to interaction of electric fields and field gradients in the trap. We also have to look at the relativistic Doppler effect to see that the ion is really well cooled and localized. And these were effects that we investigated here. And this shows just an experiment where we try to verify the agreement that is under what we would say the best possible unperturbed conditions we had in both traps we looked at compared the frequencies of the two ions each for a few minutes here in each point, and we found them to agree at the level of a few parts in 10 to the 16. So this was this is comparable to the best agreement between microwave clocks between cesium fountain that had been demonstrated, and it was limited at that time then by the control we had over electric field gradients, and that is something we have then addressed later in the next generation of these ion trap setup. But I will now come to the absolute frequency measurements. For this, we have to combine the ion frequency standard with a cesium clock in order to give us the absolute frequency in SI hertz. And at PDB, we have two cesium fountains. Well, one was used for this measurement. Say it's the primary clock of Germany, and it is standing in the same big room right next to our ion trap experiment. So schematically, this shows the setup we are using. So we have the reference laser here that drives the ion, that is short term stabilized to the reference frequency, then stabilized to the transition rate of the ion. On the other hand, we have the cesium fountain. We also use a hydrogen maser as a flywheel. And then to link these two frequencies, we use the femtosecond frequency comb generator in order to get the ytterbium frequency in units of the SI hertz as realized by the cesium fountain. And I don't want to go into the details of these measurements and of the accuracy evaluation, but here I show you the compiled results of measurements we have performed over about a 6 years, 7 years time span. So this is a day of measurements, a modified Julian date. And here is just the measured ytterbium frequency minus the average value. So you can see we can measure this number to about 14 digits or so, 15 digits, and the dispersion here and the uncertainty range here is in the few hertz range. You can see that over time we have made some progress in reducing the error bars, and that also the experiments are nicely consistent. Well, Victor may say they are over consistent with everything they mainly agree to within one sigma. And uncertainty of the last measurements here was about 2 parts in 10 to the 15. Determined by about equal contributions from the two frequency standards, that is from the ytterbium clock and from the cesium clock, and a smaller systematic uncertainty. It takes about, limited by the cesium clock, it takes about two days to measure such a data point. And so this graph here stops at in summer 2006, so just presently, last week, this week, we are working on producing another point here, but I cannot give you the number yet. But we hope we expect it to also be on the line. Well, let's see. So this is a set of data that one may use to look for constancy or for changes in fundamental constants. We need a simple model to parameterize this, and we are using what has been proposed by Savili Kaschenbaum some time ago. We write the optical transition frequency as the product of two terms of the Rydberg frequency as a common energy scale of the electromagnetic transitions in the atom, and relativistic contributions that bring the fine structure constant into play with a certain transition-specific sensitivity factor. Now, we heard about these relativistic shifts. Of course, already they are very important for heavy atoms, like for ytterbium, and they can be calculated by Flumbaum and co-workers, and these numbers are available. And so this is now the whole model we use in order to get a limit on alpha dot from this data. And the best way to get a limit from this data is to combine them with measurements performed on the mercury ion system at NIST in Boulder, and I guess Jim Berkowitz will give us some more detail about this setup later today. What's interesting about this comparison, so one could say it's a remote comparison of two single ion clocks. They have very different sensitivity factors. So here I used values published for ytterbium plus, for mercury plus. Both values are quite big, and there is a change of sign, so they differ by about 4. So if alpha changes, these two frequencies should drift apart. The link, of course, between the measurements is done by via the respective cesium fountains in both laboratories. The cesium fountains are always reported to Paris, to the BIPM, for their contributions to international atomic time. And so the labs are actually linked via the cesium fountains. And you can see that both measurements are show no significant drift with respect to their local cesium fountain, and so also the ratio does not change significantly. And from this one can now deduce limits on changes of alpha and of the Rydberg frequency. Here I have plotted in the two-dimensional plot, parameterizing relative change of alpha and of the Rydberg frequency, the available data from optical clocks published until spring of this year. So it includes the ytterbium data, the mercury data I just showed, and two additional points. There is one point from aluminum mercury, and I think this will also be covered by Jim Berkowitz in his talk today. One measurement that gives a very stringent constraint on the alpha, and combining it, we got here this constraint on the Rydberg frequency. Now in the range a few parts in 10 to the minus 16 per year. Alpha is from the aluminum measurement already in the range 10 minus 17 per year. Yes, it contains the cesium hyperfine physics. So this is in this parameterization the compilation of the data from optical clocks available. So which way are we going to obtain new results and to obtain higher sensitivity? So one system we are looking at is a strongly forbidden transition in the ytterbium ion. So this is the level scheme I showed you so far with the cooling and the reference transition, the quadrupole. And then ytterbium plus, in addition, has a still lower lying F state, which has an extremely long lifetime of about 6 years, the longest, I think the longest living known state in atomic physics. So it can only decay to the ground state via an electric octopole at a blue wavelength. So the natural line width here is something like a nanohertz or so, something that we will not be able to reach with laser spectroscopy, but it means that it offers prospects of building a single ion clock where the resolution is only limited by the laser line width and by the longest interrogation time we can spend in looking at this ion, that is basically by heating effects maybe of the ion in the trap. And this, of course, promises a single ion clock of very high stability by looking at this very narrow transition. Of course, it places very high demands on building this laser source. One needs a bit power to drive the forbidden transition, and of course, it has to be, well, this is just one number that we aim at for experiments. Of course, the laser line width will always limit the resolution here. There has been actually a significant amount of work on this transition. It has been laser driven by the group at NPL, the British Institute, and they have obtained, like, I think, measured the frequency to a few hundred hertz or so uncertainty already. So what's interesting about this transition in the context of search for variations of constants is that this transition here has a very big negative sensitivity factor. So here I've taken out the numbers from the new compilation that Victor and colleagues have put on the archive. This year there was still a slight change in the number for this transition, I think. So it means that these two transitions here differ by about 7 in delta A, really a very big factor, and I think the biggest known difference for any optical frequency standard. And what's nice here, it can be done in one and the same atom in one trap, which makes the experiment simpler and may eliminate some systematic effects. And it will be a ratio measurement independent by microwave clocks and the long distance transfer that has been used in the previous analysis I've shown you. And so this, we hope to significantly enhance the sensitivity using this system. So this experiment is being, this construction of the setup is close to being finished, and maybe we hope to get first data on this ratio this year. The other system that we have been working on for some time already, and that has already been mentioned by Victor Flambaum in his introductory talk, is thorium-229, a possible nuclear optical clock. And we are very excited about this system as it offers a wide range of interesting physics in a new borderland between atomic and nuclear physics. And also, as we have seen, it is a very sensitive system for looking at changes of fundamental constants. So here's a bit of the history and the level scheme of this transition. It is an isomer in thorium-229, an unstable thorium isotope. And it is by far the lowest lying known exciting state in all of nuclear physics. These two levels classified here in the Nielsen quantum numbers are both band heads of rotational bands of this nucleus. And so the upper excited states of these bands were very well established. And then it was known that one band head was the ground state of the nucleus, but the other band head was not seen. And then one group here, Helmer and Reich, they searched for this for quite some time, and over many years lowered consistently the energy of this level. First they said it was below 100, and they said it was below 10. And then for some time there was this measurement regarded to be the most precise from gamma spectroscopy, saying 3.5 electron volt for the transition energy, which would still be in the blue to ultraviolet region. But now last year a more precise value was published, 7.6 electron volts, which is in the vacuum ultraviolet, making it technically more difficult, but still accessible to laser techniques. This is a difference of very big numbers. And
what is the stable laser?
That was actually not clear at that point. No,
this is just, if you look for images, yes, but for just magnetic moments. Is it possible to study ground state separately? You can study ground state separately because you know basically you have ground state of the excited state. And once you have ground state, you can measure its magnetic moment.
But the ordering of the energy levels was not a priori clear. So it was.
You know, I mean another thing. So when you have two big lines, when you have one spectroscopic tape, it may be unclear which is bigger, which is smaller, yes. But when you have and this element in the ground state, you can make separate measurement and to learn what is the ground state.
You mean measure the spin, yeah.
And in this case, you should...
This is spectroscopic measurement.
This is what you get from spectra. But if you have this negative value or it overlap, go a little bit outside of zero, you should combine spectroscopic data with one more piece of data which told you what is the ground state.
Right. So I think it was established that the ground state is as a 5.5 spin. So this is just to be read, I think, as an experimental number, as a difference of
big contribution. Yeah, but if you combine it with the ground state,
that would have given 0.5.
People just present what we see. That's all. We see a difference of two gamma transition frequencies. Maybe it's actually about 40 measures. It's not many transitions. They obtain this value. We understand that minus one doesn't have a meaning, but what we see, we present. Like mass squared was neutrino. The problem existed for many years. Mass squared was negative for many years, but people still present it.
So the relevant number now that we are using as the underlying numbers for all our experimental planning is of course this one, which is precise now, you see maybe 5% or so, which spectroscopically, of course, still means there's a wide search range. But it is a fascinating system. We have proposed it as a use in a very high precision optical clock. The method that one may use, actually one may apply, very similar methods that I've shown you for the interrogation of the ytterbium forbidden transition. These methods, similar methods, may be applied to this nuclear transition. One would make kind of a double resonance experiment. So here is systematically shown the nuclear degree of freedom and an electronic transition of the thorium-229i. So we would laser cool and drive laser-induced fluorescence and observe it from a transition in the shell. And then with the second laser, one may excite the nucleus. And exciting the nucleus to this state, which is long-lived, has 10,000 seconds lifetime aboard, and has a different magnetic moment, different nuclear spin. So hyperfine structure would change, and we could read this out in the intensity of polarization change of the fluorescence on the electronic shell. And so this gives us the possibility to apply all the ideas from the single ion frequency standard to this nuclear excitation. In fact, the triply positively charged ion has a suitable level scheme for laser cooling, and the system promises a further reduction of systematic line shifts, shifts that are encountered now and that are actually limiting the ytterbium. Why is this? At first, we thought there would be a very simple hand-waving argument that the nuclear transition should more weakly coupled to external fields because nuclear moments are smaller. And there is some truth to this, but of course it's an oversimplification because the total energy of the nuclear resonance that we are driving here is composed of the purely nuclear contribution of the contribution of the energy of the electron shell in a Coulomb potential. But of course there is hyperfine structure also. And this has to be taken into account. So here I'm looking at the 3 plus ion, which has this ground state here, electronic ground state, 5-half nuclear spin, so there's a hyperfine splitting of these levels. And now if we drive the nucleus to the isomer, what happens with the ground state? So there is an isomer shift, and then there is also a different change in the magnetic moment in the hyperfine structure. And so if now we are driving a transition, we have to take these contributions into account, and it means that for the total transition frequency that we measure, it will not only be the nuclear moment, but also the electronic moments may contribute if the shifts depend not only on the electronic quantum numbers, but also on the total angular momentum or the nuclear momentum. And so if now one goes through the list of possible systematics, one finds that indeed it offers advantages over electronic transitions. So here is a list of the typical factors that are troubling in ion trap or that may eventually limit or give systematic shifts in ion trap experiments. And the green mark here indicates that we can control this at the level, say, 10^-18. And remarkably, to lowest order, at least, stark shifts and also collisions only coupled to the electronic quantum numbers, and so they would only produce a common mode shift in both states and would not bother us here.
What's left over would be things like tensor stark shifts or coupling to E field gradients, because they mix the F and the I quantum numbers. But then one has a choice within some range. One would have a choice of the electronic state in which the nuclear transition is investigated. And in fact, if it will be possible to use a state with J smaller than one, say an S 1/2 electronic state, then these tensor components vanish also. And then all these effects would be controllable.
And that is something that is not available on any kind of electronic transition. You can never get all these quantum numbers to be favorable, to take favorable values at the same time. So what remains in this case would only be higher orders, like hyperfine star shifts, that are known from the microwave cesium clocks, because then in an S1/2 state, the quantum numbers would be very similar to those of the cesium clock transition. And for cesium clocks, these shifts have, of course, been investigated, and they have to be controlled. And they are at the microhertz level or so, so that they do not impair the uncertainty of the frequency of the cesium clock beyond 10 to the minus 16 or so. And here we would have the same shifts, but relative to the optical frequency, so they would bother us much less. So that's why we think it is a superior candidate for an optical clock. And now for the context of this workshop, I'd only like to briefly flash, because it has been mentioned by Viktor Flambaum in his introduction already, that there is this very high enhancement of this sensitivity.
Which has no speed. Which has no Is it advantage
or then you would have a non-integer total spin.
Okay, that would not be an integer.
So here, there have been now a number of papers indicating that that there will be the very high sensitivity of maybe 5 orders of magnitude enhancement for this transition, and so we. This, of course, adds to the motivation of studying this transition with present atomic clocks making comparisons at the 10 to the minus 15 level that would then allow us to reach 10 to the minus 20 sensitivity level for temporal variations, combined variations of alpha and also of the quark mass. I think it will be difficult in an experiment then to disentangle these effects, but it would be an extremely sensitive probe for variations, if any, should be present. So I may spend 2-3 minutes or so on the experimental progress. Unfortunately, there's not much. So people have looked at the system a lot, but the problem is nobody has unambiguously detected the optical transition directly. So this nucleus is radioactive itself, but it has a lifetime of about 8,000 years. It is produced in an alpha decay from uranium-233, which is available in sufficient quantity, I think. And then in the alpha decay, here not only the ground state is produced, but also with about 2% probability the isomer. So in fact, these blue or VUV photons should be part of the decay chain of uranium-233. And people have looked for this, but unfortunately, as I mentioned, nobody has yet seen it. And this will be the important point to measure the wavelengths more precisely before any high-resolution work on laser spectroscopy can be performed. So we have been doing a number of simple experiments at PTB already. We tried to excite the isomer from the ground state. This was based. These experiments were based on the assuming the 3.5 electron volt transition energy, and we thought we may excite it with a lamp. We failed in detecting anything, and of course now we know that we were simply spectrally looking in the wrong window. Another method may be to use directly for the isomers produced in the uranium decay. One may use recoils. This also so far has, I think, not given any results. And the next step that we are looking now at, but which will be experimentally more difficult, is to go for trapped ions and then do multi-photon excitation. So just summarizing briefly, these experiments did not reach any result because they looked in the wrong wavelength range, and this is still work in progress. Now more groups are entering this field. I think it's very promising and very interesting. And once this first difficult step has been done to really locate this wavelength, it will be a fascinating system for further study. Okay, with this I'd like to close and acknowledge my co-workers, Christian Tamm, my senior colleague and co-project leader at PDB, and a whole list of postdocs, PhD students, and PDB staff in the clock departments that work together on these experiments. Savili for theoretical support. And with this, I'd like to close and thank you for your attention.
I'm not sure if people know the history. What was the major problem here? That people first identified this level as 3.5 electron volts, and after this new measurement showed 7.6 electron volts. So all the previous measurements basically looked at the wrong area. So the people had to start from scratch.
And it is a big
change. It wasn't information, because the alternative was such that looking into the sigma nearly means to go over all optical domain. So it was no information. It was just saying that this light, let's say, an optical domain from spectroscopic point of view. So accuracy was not enough.
And but the shift was 4C.
Yes,
so that's
it's not an optical domain, but still information from the spectroscopic point of view was limited. Could you tell about other projects to determine the transition, like Hubble project, Blue project? I think it was mentioned by Max, I don't remember, that there was, or by Victor, that there is three other projects.
Yes, so there's one group in Munich. They are looking at recoil nuclei and trying to, they have a recoil decelerator and try to implant them into a metal tip so that they get a very nice point source and want to look at that optically.
They really do that, or they just
they do it. I think they started this at the end of last year or so. They can collect the nuclei, but I'm afraid the problem with that experiment is so that the nuclei will finally be embedded in the metal, and then the nuclear transition may couple to the conduction electrons, and so I believe that dominantly the decay will not be radiated. So there will be, I would assume that there would be no photons. And other
kind of transition.
Yeah, well, it may be they have this setup and they can produce very clean sources. It may be interesting to try. Another approach is to look in a solid. One may look have a crystal with the high enough band gap implant thorium ions into a crystal and then maybe excite it with a broad band UV source. I think that's done by Eric Hudson. I'm not sure. Maybe you will say a bit more in your talk.
Mm-hmm.
Lou, I don't know very good. So he did one experiment looking at emission from a uranium solution, but it was also only sensitive at the 3.5 and EV range. Mm-hmm.
So I have two questions. First is, what is the status of nuclear structure calculations? I suppose Ab initio calculations. I suppose it's not good enough otherwise.
I'm not really the expert to answer this, but
I can answer all what I knew. I tried to attract attention to this problem. Now, three groups working on it.
Mm-hmm.
I have two papers, not unpublished yet, but there are two results. And the third results are just, the paper is about to appear, but there is a result here. Mitriv on our Bach 1 work, it's nuclear physicist, one from Institute of Nuclear Physics, another from Tel Aviv. There is another calculation with Bob Beringer from Arbon Lab, and there is a third calculation, which is probably most sophisticated one from GSI, Darmstadt, and Jacek Dobaczewski from Poland. Mm-hmm. There is
these are calculations.
But how accurate can
these calculations talk about the dependence? They're not about calculating where you think this level would be.
Ah, they don't do that?
Sorry, no, I don't forget. It's impossible. No,
it's impossible.
No,
let's say.
You ask the impossible thing, right? I want to just talking about enhancement life. Maybe you can calculate lifetime, because it's usually in one transition. But lifetime also depends on this frequency. You say it's frequency cubed. So you may make them calculate the amplitude squared and
the best guess is something like 10,000 seconds, but it may depend.
10,000 seconds for most frequencies. For new frequencies, it will be, you know, it was for frequency 3.5.
For the, yeah, but
we only calculate
that. That would be for the isolated nucleus. It may be very different. It may depend on the electronic environment of the nucleus. Should there be some resonances? Electronic resonances, then it may be significantly
shorter. If frequency is smaller, three times larger, lifetime will be 1,000 seconds. Also, if it's still 7.6, it's a neutral electron, there will be OJ electron. In iron, there are no OJ electrons, so forth. It depends, actually. And it's all kind of self-consistent problem.
So this is an order of magnitude that I think is still valid.
If the frequency is bigger, it already gives you smaller lifetime by an order of magnitude.
Did I understand, you go to thorium 3 plus, which is a complication. Is that because then you shift the electronic energy levels up so that you can feed through with the light into the nucleus?
That's one effect, yes, that's right. So the main interest in the 3 plus is, yeah, there is one electron remaining, and then one should expect maybe a simpler system spectrum, but with all energies shifted to the UV or VUV. Yeah. But fortunately, there is fine structure multipad that can be driven by infrared laser sources, and that should be efficient to laser cool it. And so there is 4 levels within 1 electron volt to the ground state, and then there is a big window where there is nothing, and so that we expect the nuclear frequencies to be relatively unperturbed by the electronic states.
Another question?
What is the status of Anna Hayes to be about the sensitivity of this?
Status as usual. Now, the problem is, there was a previous story about this octuple enhancement. They published paper, there's no octuple enhancement. Basically, they closed the Salamis experiment. And after that, they suddenly, I don't know, it was on the face of hope, but Sho Horowitz published a paper and found the bigger enhancement. So the story is the same now. They deny everything. So they don't produce any numbers. So it's my impression of what's going on. They cannot produce any numbers. They published second paper.
And maybe you can comment on this, but from our reading of that paper, they basically start on with a model where they assume things can't change, or things don't change, and therefore they get something that doesn't change.
Conclusion is wrong. They claim that it's because they don't see change of deformation, they don't see effect. But for example, the calculation with Dmitriev unknown, if deformation does not change, but neutrons change fine structure component, Coulomb energy changes by 1 MeV, mega electron volts. There's no deformation change at all. Also, if you calculate how sensitive is the Coulomb energy to deformation, it's unbelievably sensitive because it's 1 GeV, 1000 MeV. So you change deformation by 10 to the minus 4, you get 100 KeV. You see, so the fact that we don't see change in deformation means absolutely nothing. Also, there's experimental factor, rotational inertia changes by 4%. It's measured. Rotational moment changes by 4% from one state to another state. So it certainly has some change in the macroscopic properties. So they had no result, again, and they again published a paper about that. They published a paper, but they have no result. We don't know. So the three works I'm talking about, where are results? Okay, there's always question about accuracy, but they are all in the same range. They're completely different. Obviously, frankly speaking, I didn't tell that they were doing calculations until the last moment. But they are completely independent, they get completely different numbers, and they are all in the same range. There isn't one. Any other questions? Okay, so we can proceed to lunch. And